The content presented in this radio show, hosted by the attorneys of Legacy Legal Planning, LLC, is intended for educational purposes only. It does not constitute legal advice, and listeners are strongly advised not to rely on the information provided for specific legal decisions. Legacy Legal Planning, LLC, and its attorneys are not responsible for any actions taken based on the content of this show. For personalized legal advice, listeners are encouraged to consult with a duly licensed attorney in their respective state.
1510 WMAX Quincy Boston and 101.1 FM W266 DQ Weymouth. WMAX Quincy Boston. Streaming at WMAXBoston.com and on your smart speaker, just say play WMAX. The greatest hits of all time are back. This is the all-new WMAX.
WMAX Boston.
Legacy Legal Live. Hosted by Kendra O'Toole, Michelle Reed, and Elizabeth Caruso of Legacy Legal Planning, is a show about discussing your estate plans, options, and answering your questions. Call in at 781-834-9639 and start your lifelong partnership covered by benefits that you've earned through proper legacy planning. Now here's your hosts, Kendra, Michelle, and Elizabeth.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us this evening on Legacy Legal Live here on WMEX Boston. We are from Legacy Legal Planning. We're three attorneys, and we'll be speaking a bit about some estate planning and probate tonight. I am Kendra O'Toole.
I'm Michelle Reed.
And I am Elizabeth Caruso.
So as we have been talking in the past few weeks, we've been doing a weekly journal prompt to help you create your legacy story if you've been following along. These can be found on our Instagram, LinkedIn, and Facebook. All three handles for that are at Legacy Legal Planning. You can also listen to past episodes on WMEXBoston.com and go to the Legacy Legal Live page to listen to the past shows as well. And so today I'm going to have Liz talk about our journal prompt and a little story.
So this is week six, and our week six journal prompt is talk about a time that you went to work with your parent. And I'm not sure if this is like a rite of passage for all of us, but I definitely went to work with my mom on weekends when she had to do some extra hours, or, you know, she picked me up at school and brought me back to the office when she needed to do some extra work. I'm sure that COVID has kind of changed the perception of all of this, because a lot of people now work from home. So, you know, going to work with your parents looks a whole lot different. But I'm going to take you back to the early 90s. And my mom did medical billing, and the company she worked for actually had a contract with McLean Hospital. So we would drive up to Belmont on a Saturday, and she would have me alphabetize things. And we'd put on the radio, we'd listen to music, I'd have lunch with her and her coworkers. And my prize or reward, we'll call it, for good behavior and good knowledge of the alphabet was always a gigantic ice cream sundae from this place called Chadwick's, which was in Newton. It's like if Friendly's was one place and like owned by like one family, it was so awesome. It was really cool. So I highly enjoyed going with my mom. Although now when I have to alphabetize something, I literally go back to that and be like, I have to go through the whole alphabet again every time.
Why did I think your story would involve more mischief, Liz?
I loved it.
I mean, there probably was mischief somewhere along the way, but mostly I was motivated by ice cream.
Aren't we all? I know back in the day, it used to be a bring your child to work day that a lot of businesses did. My aunt worked for 9X going way back.
Boy. Did they do the telephone book?
And they did. It was the whole, you know, company that's now Verizon.
Okay.
Yep,
okay.
Exactly. That was 9X and has gone through all their changes. And it was bring your child to work day. So I went with her to that. But yeah, it was a legit, let's do this and have a fun time for the kids.
That sounds like a terrible idea.
I literally would never.
We've done that at the office a couple of times. We have had the kiddos in the office.
Just wait till Tuesday, election day. It'll be another bring your child to work day.
So if you are following along, we hope that prompt just brings up some memories that you had, either of you going with your parent or maybe when you brought your child with you to work. And we also want to mention, we talked about last week, on May 8th, we are having our senior celebration that we are co-hosting with South Shore Senior News. And this is the 29th annual event, and it's going to be held at the Holiday Inn in Dedham from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. This is a great opportunity to meet different services and companies that have different benefits and ways that they can help seniors, whether it's assisted livings or home health or financial advisors, tax, moving, downsizing, all that type of stuff. So come check it out to learn about some services that you might need in the future, or if you're a caregiver, some services that you might need for a loved one. We'd love to have you come check it out. So this week's topic is navigating probate in Massachusetts.
I feel like we need to go dun dun dun.
We definitely need some type of Law and Order type music for this one. I know that we allude to probate a lot during our show, and I feel like when we sat down to think about what we were going to talk about, we decided that it was probably time to actually devote a show to talking about, like, what is this, you know, elephant in the room that we always talk about as far as, you know, probate, and what does probate entail? So probate in Massachusetts is the court that deals with wills and trusts and estates and divorces. So it kind of like is all encompassing in all of those categories. We obviously don't deal with the domestic relations part, thankfully.
And I was going to say, that's why it is very important when you are looking for an attorney to help with the probate, that's the wills and trusts, that you are specific with exactly what you need, because people do kind of throw out, I'm looking for a probate lawyer, and that could mean child support, custody, you know. So it is important to really research and look for an attorney that really practices in exactly the type of probate that you're looking for.
And that's another reason why a lot of our probate court cases get bogged down, is because we're lumped in, or, you know, I say we, but, like, you know, the wills and the trust cases are all lumped in with domestic relations cases. So divorces, child custody, child support, all of those cases. And they're all heard at the same time by the same judges. And there are a whole lot more of those than there are of the wills and the trust cases. So, you know, we sometimes get put to the back burner. But, you know,
we get to hear all the good stuff.
We do get a front row seat to a lot of fights sometimes. There are sometimes I can sit in probate court and I'm like, I could just sit here with a bowl of popcorn and just watch.
And like you said, it kind of does really get placed on the back burner, in the sense that a lot of times when it's for a wills and trust issue, it's not considered an emergency because no one's health or safety or well-being is really at risk at the time.
Right. So any type of case involving a will, the administration of a will, allowance of a will, any type of a trust case where you're litigating a trust or something like that, or trying to change a trustee or a beneficiary when it's not clearly written in a trust. Anytime that you need a guardianship or a conservatorship, these are all considered probate cases in Massachusetts. So every county has a probate court. Some have multiple locations, like we are sitting in Plymouth County and there's a probate court in Plymouth and in Brockton. Some are obviously busier than others based on the county. We joke, and I, you know, there's probably not very many listeners in Western Massachusetts, but I have a case out there in Springfield, and we joke that I FedExed something on Friday and I actually had the return document approved and everything by Monday. And I was like, wow, they are very efficient out
there. Not around here. Yeah.
Don't get used to that here in the eastern part of the state. Most of the cases that we are seeing at Legacy Legal are probate administration cases, meaning that someone has passed away, they left a will, and or they didn't leave a will, and there are assets in the name of the deceased person that need to be distributed to their beneficiaries. So whoever they said in the will or whoever is going to take via intestate succession with the state. And there's a whole process as to how to, you know, properly get that started so that the financial institutions and, you know, banks and, you know, if you have to sell real estate, things like that, everybody has the proper authority to actually get done what they need to get done.
And these are assets that are in your name alone without a beneficiary. So if you have life insurance where you named somebody as the beneficiary on the specific policy, that trumps and that doesn't need the court process. This is specifically assets that are in your name alone. But also don't run and just add people onto your accounts. Beneficiary is the best way to go rather than joint owners. So we're not saying to just, you know, I know commonly people to avoid the court and try to make things easy might say, oh, I added on my daughter and she knows that the $100,000 I have in my checking account, even though she's the joint owner, she then needs to split between her other five siblings. And that never turns out right. There's always some issues with that. And you also then trigger tax issues and gifting issues, let alone with some, you know, contention between the siblings. So these are really assets that are in your name alone without a beneficiary.
Yeah, and that brings up an important sort of riff off of what Liz was saying. She alluded to probate, whether you have a will or not. Oftentimes we have clients or, you know, potential clients who say, well, you know, my loved one left a will, so why do we need to go through probate? And in Massachusetts, regardless of whether or not you've left a will, if there are assets in your name and your name alone, as Kendra said, there's still a probate process. It might look slightly different, but not too much different, actually.
It's literally just a couple different check boxes. Otherwise, it's entirely the same process. And it's really that you have pre-chosen who's going to be in charge of the distribution of your estate and who's going to receive the assets from your estate, as opposed to the state dictating that. But, you know, whether you have a will or not, a will guarantees that your family will go through probate. The only way that you avoid probate is through joint ownership, beneficial interests, and having assets titled the outside of your name, typically through a trust.
And the probate process is something that, you know, a lot of our clients, when they talk to us, they want to avoid it. And so we are going to talk a little bit of step by step of what it looks like, you know, here in Massachusetts, of when somebody has now passed away, there's assets in their name alone. Whether they left a will or not, there are about, I think it's 8 forms probably, mm-hmm. that need to be filled out with a lot of times repeating information.
And they are not in plain English.
No.
They are written with like double negatives and all sorts of bizarre phrasing that like I've filled them out hundreds of times. I still have to sit there and go word by word to make sure I'm answering things correctly.
Yeah, they're not simple forms. They might want some of the same information on each form, but they definitely have a lot of questions that you may not even know what some of the words mean. There is legalese as well on these forms, as much as they're, I think, tried to made for people to be able to do them themselves. It's really not. It really does require that help. So it starts with those forms, filling them out and filing that along with a will or no will, depending on what you've.
And what's important about the will is that you really need to have the original will. If you don't have the original will with like the wet ink signature, then you need to file different types of probate and you need to check off different boxes and you might need to file affidavits and things like that if you're just filing a copy, which can be, that can, it can enter problems.
And subject to not the counties that we typically frequent, but a county that shall remain nameless will potentially force the attorney to go in person to explain that we're purporting a copy of the will. And in order for an attorney to go into this county in person, it's a full day event to speak to the judge for 30 seconds.
And they need not just the original will, if there is one, but also an original certified death certificate. And these documents get kept by the court. Many, you know, clients at first feel, oh, can you give me back that original when you're done with it? Or, you know, right.
Nope.
It is with the court. It is now you are donated. Not getting it back.
Yeah. And the forms ask for, you know, easy general information at the start, you know, the name and address and age of the decedent, the name and address of the person filling out the paperwork, who's known as the petitioner. And then as you go through, you have to identify whether or not there's a will, when it was written, whether or not there's going to be sureties, which is an insurance policy that the person who's going to be in charge of the distribution won't run away with all the money. Typically, it's the same person who's getting the distribution, so it's a little superfluous. But and then there's a form called the surviving spouse and heirs at law form, where you have to put whether or not there was a surviving spouse, and then you have to list who would be the next of kin according to intestate succession. And that's whether there's a will or not. So there's a separate form for when there's a will and who's getting the assets from the will. That's called a devisee's form. But the surviving spouse heirs at law form can be kind of confusing because you have to list out people who may or may not actually be involved in the case whatsoever. You know, there might be, you know, children who have been excluded from the will and you still need to give them notice. Children and spouses need to be noticed when a will of the person who's passed away gets filed in probate, whether they're receiving anything or not, whether they have the right to object or not in your eyes. You know, they have to have notice because they may have a right to object even if there is a will that says they get nothing.
So these forms all kind of just ensure that the court knows all the players that need to be involved. And then there's also the bond, as you mentioned, which is the form that kind of says, this is how much we think an estimate of what everything is worth for this probate, and I'm going to do what's right. And then there are assents that we usually try to get, if possible, from the heirs or the beneficiaries saying that they agree to the petitioner filing it with the court. It just makes the process a little easier. It can save some money in regard to notice and stuff if people, depending on how many people are there and if they're at the meeting. But these, the people involved, as you mentioned, can really get, go down the ladder depending on the family. And if they had children, oh, no children, their parents, siblings, nieces, nephews, it really goes down the line. And also on those forms, it asks about anybody that might be under some type of incapacity or guardianship or conservatorship. If somebody is not able to make their own decisions, but they are an heir or a beneficiary that's to be receiving, the court also needs to know that and also needs to see who actually has that decision-making power on their behalf.
Mm-hmm. The court also wants to know, there's a military affidavit. They want to know if anybody's serving in the military. Because they get special types of notice or extended notice to make sure that, you know, they are properly represented if they're supposed to play a part in this, you know, in this estate administration. Go ahead.
So once all this stuff is kind of filed with the court and you have the nice packet that you're giving, they will go through it with a fine-tooth comb, and if they feel that there might have been a box checked off wrong or anything, they don't process anything. They send it all back, and you kind of start at square one again of fixing whatever the issue is.
It's also important to note that every county will go through and have, they have their own fine-tooth comb. So what is accepted and as filed in one county, another county might say, nope, this is how we do it. And they send it all back. So it's very important to, and frankly, you know,
same forms, different roles.
And from one filing to the next, you know, they could then, you know, switch what they have going on behind the scenes. So those types of things can be cumbersome.
I literally had two cases in one county, same county, did it all one way, all approved, no problem. Did the next case the same exact way, same scenario. They came back and said they wanted it a different way. Same county. It's just...
it's all who you get as the person who reviews it, too. And sometimes the workers at a court will change courthouses because they get a
transfer?
Not a transfer, but they get a raise promotion. Or a promotion. That's the word. I speak English. So, you know, they get a promotion or something like that. And they then take all of their, like, internal rules from the court that they learned to work at and bring them to the new court. So now you have, like, inter-county different rules based on who's actually reviewing your paperwork. It can be insane.
So once those are finally filed, and there's always a filing fee that's included that needs to be done, that averages around $405.
Which is actually, it's really interesting that our filing fee is only $400 at $405 maximum. From talking to practitioners in other states, a lot of states have the fee based on a percentage of the estate.
Right.
So like Connecticut actually does it this way, and you can pay thousands and thousands of dollars in fees to the court. And Massachusetts, it's $405 maximum. There are some filings that are $390, and there are some filings that are only $115. Whether it's $26,000 or $26 million, it's $405 to file the probate.
And that's to just file. There are other fees that come into play later down the line.
Correct.
Yeah. And so once that's done, depending on the route you went, there's kind of two things. One, you could get a citation that says you need to give notice to everybody or have those assents by X date. And anybody that's has an interest has until that date to put in an objection if they feel so inclined. And you also have to publish in the newspaper and give notice to the Division of Medical Assistance and maybe some other parties as well, depending on the specific case. And this notice needs to be done within that time frame. There, one thing might say this needs to be done 14 days before the date on this form. Another one might say this needs to be done 7 days before the date on this form. So that is all about notice, making sure people are informed. You need to publish in the newspaper, which again could range from $150 to $800.
I did one today. It was $400.
Yeah. And I've seen ones that have been $600.
So we're just over $800 right now.
And so that publication is, and the notice to heirs is crucial because that just puts everyone aware and allows the court to either move forward with appointing the personal representative, or there may need to be hearings if there's an objection.
Mm-hmm. And if there's an objection, there would then be a pretrial scheduled to have a hearing on the objection. There might be an evidentiary hearing about why there is an objection. And that's where litigation can go on and on and on and on and on. If there is no objection, then the person who petitioned the court to be the personal representative and to represent the estate and to actually distribute out the assets gets appointed. They get what's called letters of authority. Those letters of authority are what you then take to the bank. They're what you, you know, send to an insurance company and things like that to actually get the assets cashed out.
So when you have these financial institutions and other companies that you're dealing with in regard to your loved one's estate, when they say we need a court order, you'll hear that phrase quite a bit. These letters of authority and a decree, those are the court orders that we're referencing. That's sort of what we call your golden ticket to get access, to get information, because some of these companies won't even speak to you, won't give you a lick of information without that quote unquote court order. So we've all the things we've just talked about, we don't even have a court order yet. We're just getting it at that point.
And if, especially with real estate, I know we've kind of talked about trusts a lot and whatnot, this, these letters of authority that you're waiting for, depending on the court, could take anywhere from 2 months to 4 to 5 months, 6 months before you even get this. So if you have real estate, it's just sitting there because it cannot be put on the market. It cannot be sold or anything until this power comes in. So this is really where the person finally has the authority to be able to move forward with the rest of the probate.
We'd love to say we have a party, but then it's everything's just getting started.
Which I think is a really good point right now to take our break. That way, when we come back, we'll talk about the rest and the remainder of the probate. So you are listening to Legacy Legal Live on WMEX Boston, and we'll be back.
We are a staple in the neighborhood. Most of our customers have been coming here since they were children for 75 years. It's been the Fowler House since 1946. And so there's a lot of memories here. And so when people think of Quincy Center, they do think of the Fowler House. We're in our 43rd year here at the Fowler House, and we haven't changed much. We are going to add a few new menu items. We're going to spruce up some of the ones that we already have on the menu. We're going to improve on a few appetizers, adding pulled pork to the menu permanently on the sandwich side, adding Italian sandwich. So it's going to broaden the sandwich offerings. We're also going to add a special burger in the name of someone at WMEX. We're going to roll out a new drink list, adding some winter flavors and then some permanent items such as some new margaritas, bourbon smashes, old fashions, kind of get back to that traditional cocktail menu. Fowler House Cafe, located at 1049 Hancock Street, and online at thefowlerhousecafe.com. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and you can, of course, hear us on the airwaves at 1510 WMEX.
Are those high electricity bills getting you down? Do you wish you could find a way to cut your costs and become self-sustaining? Call Solar Grids Boston. They're a locally owned, locally operated solar energy management company. They're licensed and insured with electricians and builders on board and have been in the industry for the last 40 years. You can find them on Facebook and at solargridsboston.com or call Jim at 508-731-8853. Again, 508-731-8853. Tell him Joe sent you.
And we are back. You're listening to Legacy Legal Live, and you have with us tonight from Legacy Legal Planning, Kendra O'Toole, Michelle Reed, and Elizabeth Caruso. For the first half, we've been talking about the probate process. We've talked a lot on our calls about, on our shows about what probate is and how to avoid it, but we've never really gone into the deep dive of the actual process for you. So we're doing that this evening. The first half, we did talk about kind of the opening up a probate initially and getting somebody appointed and that court order, the letters of authority for them to be able to step in. If you have any questions that have been triggered in this last half an hour, please call 781-834-9639. We'd love to hear from you tonight.
Or if you are triggered in general by the probate process and need to just talk to someone who understands, we are here.
You can call our office for that at 781-971-5900. We do want to just give a little reminder as well that we are doing the weekly journal prompt, and that this week's journal prompt was to write about a time that you went to work with your parent. So just for those that have been following along and creating their legacy story, I just wanted to put that out there for you. And we are now going to jump into some of the roles and duties that a personal representative has to carry out in the probate process. And one of the first big things is inventorying, gathering and determining exactly what is a probate asset and how to contact companies and get the funds and put them into an estate account and go through that process.
Yeah, this usually takes place like throughout the entire like probate opening process, where you're going through the paperwork and the house of the person who had passed away and trying to figure out if they, you know, didn't leave a detailed list. Some people do, most people don't, of, you know, their assets, and trying to figure out, you know, where their bank accounts were and, you know, where they had retirement funds and where they had life insurance policies and things like that. We often tell people, you know, look through the mail. that has come, or look at past tax returns. That can tell you, you know, where some of these assets are actually held.
And I was actually going to say, we usually say look through the mail, and then, but now one of the hardest things that I think we're finding is that so many people receive their statements and everything online.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just one more difficult way for people to determine. So if you do online statements, which is great, you know, and it's wonderful to have that. But like you said, maybe leave a list of kind of here's the accounts I have, an account at Rockland Trust, an account at Wells Fargo, whatever it might be. And with just some general information for them to be able to access that. Because for the most part, with a social security number and at least knowing what bank to go to, things can be taken care of.
Yeah, I have been appointed by the court before. For estates where family members weren't super close to the deceased, and they were pretty much told me, yeah, we don't know what they had, and I'm starting at like zero as far as information, and I'm just cold calling banks to be like, so you got an account for Sally? Because Sally died and I'm in charge of Sally's estate. No money for Sally? Okay, thanks. And I just call the next bank. And, you know, you go through, you know, 15 local banks because they've changed names or whatever, or based on where people live, you know, there's, you have no idea where they actually did their banking. It's infuriating.
And I mean, that's just the quote simple stuff, right? Calling 15 banks is simple. Then you have to consider some of the more obscure things like safe deposit boxes. Then you're calling the banks again. So things that you might not necessarily consider in terms of finding assets, finding missing money. We've had to, you know, search that for clients countless times where we found some significant assets and do that beforehand.
I was going to say, pro tip right now, search your name. If you have any, get it now. It's much easier while you're living for you to get that money now than for somebody to deal with it later.
We've had some probates where, you know, the decedent had quote unquote missing money. You don't quite know what it is. They give you enough information for you to get real excited that there might be some significant assets out there. But it can be, what, a 6-month process, even more?
Story time. Everybody buckle up. I had an estate once where the personal representative basically abandoned the estate. The personal representative is the person who's appointed by the court. So they basically said, I'm not doing this anymore, and walked away from the process. This person had no children, so there was nobody really like putting their feet to the fire to get it done. 10 years went by, and all of the person's accounts, the dead person's accounts, ended up with the unclaimed property division in Massachusetts. So we had to go through unclaimed property for hundreds of thousands of dollars. Like, I'm talking, this estate ended up being like $1.6 million. This woman had, you know, shares of stock everywhere. And it all ended up in unclaimed property because the estate abandoned, or the personal representative abandoned their duties. So we had to get a new personal representative appointed who was then going to actually do the work and then start to go through the process with all of these companies and the unclaimed property division to actually cash out all these accounts. And what's really funny is that she passed away in, I think, 2007 or 2008, but because the accounts all sat dormant and the stock market was so good in like 2010 to 2015, the value of the estate like tripled.
Oh my gosh.
Because the money just sat there.
Who ended up with the money?
I know. So, like, was the personal representative wrong for abandoning the estate and making all these people more money? Who knows?
But do yourself a favor.
There's a lot of legal fees.
Search it out now. If you have anything in there, you know, do the legwork now. It's much easier.
And do like Kendra does. Search it for your family, too. Find them some missing money.
Don't be throwing out my secrets there.
She does it for all of us. Every now and again, she'll be like, hey, I searched your name today. There's nothing for you. You know?
I did you a service.
I do. That is exactly what it is. It's a service for others.
It was free. You're welcome.
I do. I've done it for
take payment and coffee.
I think I've done it for like literally all my extended family. Hey, anyone can just search the name. And if I'm giving them the solid tip of you have some money out there, I think that's a pretty good free tip right there. So I try to help them out. So once you are appointed and you've started to gather all the assets, you have to give an inventory to the court of here are the assets that are in the estate. And that is just to allow everyone to be on the same page and understand what is included as a probate asset. And that is just probate assets. Somebody had life insurance that passed outside and went to a beneficiary that does not get put on this inventory. These are only assets that need that court authority to have access to. And as you're gathering these assets, you also would have had to receive a tax ID number for the estate and opened up an estate account. And that's where all these checks will be going into. You know, you'll be closing their personal account that they have at Citizens, and you'll be putting the money into this estate account. So all the funds will have to go in there. And depending on the type of assets and if anything was made, as you mentioned, that one that made a bunch of money in that time frame, that during this time frame as well, you might need to file income tax returns, not only for the person that the estate that you're doing for their final year of living, dependent, you know, they need to still file their last years of taxes, but also for the estate itself.
And that's a step that gets often overlooked, you know, for many, many reasons, but especially if you're doing it on your own. It's not something that you most people even think of. Just as you mentioned, final personal income taxes from when the decedent was still living, and also the estate income taxes. And it can't hurt to get your tax professional kind of involved. The sooner the better, because that way, 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 way down the line, when you are looking to close out the estate, hopefully, you know, we're not causing any delays by having a tax professional get acquainted far too late in the process.
And these fees of, you know, working with a CPA or hiring an attorney, or, you know, if you need to hire out a clean out person for the home, whatever it may be, if there are assets in the estate, those assets can pay for these items. And even for a funeral, if there was a loved one that prepaid for the funeral, because the funeral sometimes, oftentimes they say we need payment now before they'll even move forward with anything. And so if somebody fronted that as a loan, then they can also be paid back, you know. So the kind of end of life stuff for this loved one also can be paid out of these funds. This is not something that the personal representative is personally liable for paying all these fees. The filing fee with the court, somebody has to front that. So that person can be reimbursed. A retainer to an attorney, that person can be reimbursed. And so these funds are here for the purpose of paying for any expenses of the estate, but then for distribution later to the beneficiaries of what's left over.
And depending upon what makes up the estate, there could be extra court processes that need to be gone through in order to actually distribute out the assets. You know, letters of authority are enough to close a bank account and, you know, get into a retirement account or a life insurance policy that doesn't have a beneficiary designation. But just having letters of authority is not enough to sell real estate, unless the person had a will and the will specifically says that the person in charge of the estate, the personal representative, has the authority to sell real estate. You need that authority from the court. And that's a whole other petition called a license to sell. And you need to file that with the court along with the purchase and sale agreement for the property. You have to prove to the court that it's being sold for the highest and best value and that it's a good deal for the beneficiaries. And this is another process that can take a long time. Usually courts will work with us because they know real estate transactions, you know, are done kind of on a last minute basis, or time is of the essence and things like that. But sometimes their hands are tied and they can't. And, you know, we're waiting months for these letters of authority to be able to pass clean title from an estate to a purchaser.
It could even be an extra publication in the newspaper, depending on the situation. So like you said, that really drags it out. And we've seen ones where they've lost buyers, mm-hmm. you know, and then you're back again at square one because you need to resubmit everything when the next purchase and sale agreement comes in. And so, and even with a will, as you mentioned, it needs to be specifically in there. I have had clients come to me that had their will done, you know, elsewhere, and that power wasn't in there. So even though their mother had a will, we still had to go through all these hoops that could have been avoided if that power was in there.
Or if they had put the property in a trust and done estate planning.
But I wasn't quite going that far. I was just sticking to the probate level.
But like, but you're starting to get an idea as to why we say it's always best to put real estate into a trust. Because, you know, we're now talking about two separate court petitions and court actions that need to be processed on a multiple month basis before you can sell real estate. And real estate costs money. There are real estate taxes. There might be a mortgage. There is, you know, insurance. You have to keep the heat on because we live in Massachusetts and we have winters. Like, so maybe if it's, you know, in the summer, it's not so bad. But in the winter, the pipes can freeze. And when the pipes freeze, the house gets destroyed. I literally had that happen in an estate once where they weren't paying attention and the they let the heat go down too low and the pipes froze. The whole first floor of the house had to be gutted before they could then sell the house. So now you're not talking about court interference. Now you're talking about insurance interference and contractors and all of that. I mean, that added 2 years to this estate.
It's a lot. Just going to put that out there. It is a lot. And so while they're going through this process is open for a minimum of 1 year. Creditors have a year to come in and say, hey, we have this credit card from 20 years ago that wasn't paid and we're still owed. And I've had numerous people that say, nope, my dad didn't have any debt. Everything, every credit card was paid off, this or that. They creep out of the woodwork. Because they might have stopped sending those letters. They might have stopped trying to actually collect during that person's lifetime because they knew they'd have an opportunity to try to collect in the future if something happened to that person.
And they hire people to just troll the probate filings. I mean, I've seen these people actually at the probate court who will sit there at the end of the day and go through the computers and the docket numbers and see what the new dockets are and just write down the names. And then they bring them back and put them through their databases to see if there are any outstanding debts owed from these people.
And so much of this is online now, too, that I'm sure a lot of these companies even can probably have some form of AI set up for it to run and figure it out.
I was, to Liz's point, I was at the probate court and I went to reach for the same, they called my client's file, but they handed it to a strange man and he was one of those lovely professionals that they had hired to run through the probate court. So it's important to point out that these matters are public.
And so nothing can be done really, you know, distributions don't get made to people generally within that first year because as a personal representative, you have a duty to be sure that any debts or anything are paid and owed. And if you give out money to beneficiaries and
you're
then
not getting it back.
Right. And a creditor comes in and it was within the proper time frame and you gave that money out early, the beneficiaries have spent it. They have used it on whatever and you're not getting that back. And now in that situation, you do have personal liability because you breached your duty of ensuring that all of the, you know, debts and everything were properly paid out of the estate. If there was not enough money in the estate to begin with, you are not personally liable. But if you create that, you know, issue, you could be on the hook for that. So it's crucial to, you know, follow these rules and be sure that you are going each step of the way to not have any personal liability.
And that's an excellent point if you are someone who's been appointed or you anticipate that you will be appointed, because what we often find is there are beneficiaries hounding you. Where's the money? When are we getting the distributions? You're the one responsible, but you're feeling a lot of pressure. So it is important that you get the right advice to just say, listen, you know, my hands are tied. And, you know, frankly, you can sometimes blame it on the lawyers if we're involved. We can help in that respect and help explain what the process is. But to that point, you know, it can seem like, let me just, you know, distribute things to my siblings to get them off my back. But there can be a liability factor involved.
And that year is really just a date passing. You're not going to get to the year, oh, they passed away on February 10th. It's now February 11th. And here's your money. That's not how the process is going to work because you then need to go into accounting to the court. You need to show the court where the funds went, if there were, you know, any funds already paid out. And then once you are at the point of, okay, taxes are paid, everything's all set, we can do distributions, you need to, on that account, show to the court, okay, here's what we started with on the inventory. Here's what we paid out. Maybe here's some more money that came in from tax refunds or any, you know, insurance refunds or anything. And then here's the distributions we made to the beneficiaries. And you then prepare that and present it to the court in hopes of then going to closing the estate as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I know that Michelle and Kendra have both alluded to this, but beneficiaries don't like to be told that they have to wait for their money. I have, you know, we sometimes talk to people about doing like really conservative partial distributions, and we make people sign releases that very clearly say, if we gave you too much money, you are liable to give it back to me.
And you would think, you know, sometimes people think, oh, if I give a partial distribution, it'll get them off my back, like you mentioned. But I've had somebody, you know, recently that just, I think it was about 2.5-3 months ago, they got $70,000. And then they were knocking back again, looking for the last, like, all that's left that's going to go to them is $3,000. We're just making sure that we're waiting for one more income tax refund or something that with the IRS. So they're just waiting for that. And it's literally $3,000 more. He already got 70K and he's, you know, knocking saying, where's my remaining 3K? They want it.
Some people want to be in charge of their own money and don't like other people making the decisions for them.
And the biggest thing to remember, it wasn't their money. They're getting it because it's, you know, somebody left it to them. And that's, I think, sometimes.
But they're entitled.
And that's sometimes the hardest thing is that all of a sudden people are like, oh, I need to pay my mortgage. And it's like, what were you going to do if Auntie didn't pass away? You know, like, unfortunately, it's kind of like we feel bad because, you know, they're like, oh, I need to pay my mortgage or whatever. But at the same token, it's like, you didn't know this money was going to be coming today. Right. Like, what were you going to do?
Right.
And so it's like, you just kind of get stuck in that. You feel bad, but at the same time, it's like, what were you going to do here?
And we, you know, we're obviously talking about horror stories. We have plenty of clients where this works out really well. And everybody's happy and everybody gets along.
Yeah.
And, you know, these can be, you know, happy meetings where we joke around and, you know, the year passes and, you know, people are like, oh, OK, well, we'll wait for the court to be done. And then, you know, I wasn't expecting this money. So this is great. And now I can, you know, do X, Y, Z to the house that I was hoping to do someday, or I can pay for my kids' college and things like that. So, you know, it's not all angry people.
But even with the happy people, you do a trust, it's shorter and less fees, so they're even happier.
Yes.
And they all had something in common. They had a plan. That's where the important thing comes back around. And, you know, I think if one horror story has led into another, that's really the big takeaway here, folks. And if you don't have your plan in place, you need to get one in place. And I think these ladies right here are exactly who you need to be talking to do so. Shameless self-promotion there. I'll do it for you. No problem.
And so once the distributions have been made to the beneficiaries, you know, all expenses are paid, then you are filing that account. And there's another petition with another filing fee.
And 8 more forms.
That you file with the court to say, hey, I've done my duty. I've distributed the assets. Here's where it all went and what it looked like. And please close out and take me off the hook.
Yeah. Please, please.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, what can add a lot more issues to this is, what if somebody died along the way? I've had personal representatives who've passed away where I've had to petition to get new personal representatives for an estate. I have had beneficiaries pass away. So then that beneficiary's distribution is held up until their probate is done and their heirs are proven. And it can go on and on and on.
And I know I've talked about this, I think at one of our very first shows, I had a client that came to me, his wife passed away. So we did everything, got him appointed as personal representative, like you said. In that situation, it was a blended family. So he was to get a portion and then her two children were to get a portion. And he then passed away a few months after that. And then as we were still in the process and working on appointing a new person, one of her children then passed away as well. So we had, and they owned, she owned the home herself. So there were three probates that we ended up having to open and process to deal with this one real estate.
Yeah, it can cause a lot more extra work, which is unfortunate when all this work could have been avoided.
So we hope that we have kind of enlightened you as to exactly how the whole process works. Where we say that minimum of 1 year, it usually is closer to like a year and a half by the time. And some are even more, depending on if there's tax issues. There's some that we have open that somebody didn't file taxes for the 10 years before they passed away, and they're needing to clean this up as well.
What if there are savings bonds involved? Oh. Yeah, that adds some time.
Yes, that doesn't sound fun or easy.
Michelle and I had one
we
with...
We actually have an unpaid plug to Rockland Trust.
Yes.
They were wonderful in our case. Tell that story.
There were 50. I believe it was 50, right? 50 bonds? No.
They were close to 200.
You're right. Sorry. And they need a medallion stamp, not just a notary. They need something stronger from a bank. And we had a little system all set up. It was Michelle and I, and then also our client, and then the banker. And we'd have a whole system of who filled out what, then it got passed to the next person, and he'd stamp it and sign it, and, you know, it all went down the line.
Patience of a saint.
We were there for hours to go through all those savings bonds, because every single one needed a medallion stamp. It couldn't just be a one stamp covers these 200 bonds, and it was insane.
And an insane amount of money at the end of the day, but it did prolong the process, to Liz's point. To a happy end for the beneficiaries, nonetheless.
But and now, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think that most banks will cash savings bonds in person. You have to mail them now to the federal government, and they have one central clearinghouse in Minnesota. So you then have to put it in a FedEx.
That's what
and
we had
trust
to
that's going to get to the correct place.
Oh, yeah. What do you mean trust?
Yeah, exactly.
No, that is the trust.
Yeah. Well, like when FedEx says, oh, do you want to insure this? You're like, oh, there's $50,000 of savings bonds in
LOL,
here.
LOL, no, we don't want to do anything of the sort.
That medallion stamp is just to say, yes, this person is, you know, correct, proper. That's all it is. And like you said, we then had to ship all of those to the federal government. It's mm-hmm. not something that the bank was able to actually
that then takes their sweet time cashing out.
It literally could have been worse. They could have been like, fax it.
I don't know. I might have preferred faxing.
I know. Yeah. Then we can hang on to the originals.
Right? That's true.
And have proof of everything. I mean, FedEx, even as much as you might get a signature or something, that's still, oh, you know, dot sign for this. Like, people's signatures are X's. And
random aside, but another pro tip. When you are doing things, when you're sending things original, in particular, the stock stuff, when you're sending these, you know, transfer on death forms back, send them certified so that you have proof. Just a random side tip, but certified. So you've got all that proof
and tracking. Anything that you can track, like, do it. If you do send a fax, keep that cover sheet that says, this fax was sent on X date and received and went through properly. And
what's a fax?
Somebody asked us the other day, and we actually had to scramble to be like, where do we even fax anymore?
Legacy,
did I say it right?
We have fax. We have access to all of it. We joke when we say we just don't have carrier pigeon, but we could probably figure it out.
Because you know who still uses fax?
MassHealth.
MassHealth and the IRS.
Yep. You're
darn right.
Yeah. Oh, look, the court. We're getting e-file in Massachusetts. So, you know, we're slowly but surely making waves around here. We've got e-file now.
We are moving on up, I tell you.
And so we hope at least this has opened your eyes a little bit of maybe some planning that you can do to make things easier for your loved ones. If you want to keep things hard, you can plan.
Don't make your life our next show.
You know, it is, we do talk a lot about the horror stories. That is what we're talking about. But we give these horror stories because they happen more than you think. And unfortunately, they are all things that could have been avoided. And that's what we like to do for our clients. We like to help avoid conflict, help avoid the court, help avoid just more stress. Most people, when they're dealing with this process, are going through a grieving process, you know. And so it's already tough on them. And to then have them go through this process is even harder.
Yeah. And as you can tell, we try not to scare the you-know-what out of you most of the time. We try to do it with some levity, bring some lightheartedness to it because, you know, we are talking about some serious stuff, emotionally charged things. But if you know, if you can bring some laughter into the process, but also, you know, motivate you to do things in a way, we, you know, we're of service there too.
In regard to, you know, just tying up kind of that probate process and things that you can do to avoid that. When we talk about the probate process today, that is just when someone's passed away. We have talked on previous shows about lifetime probate process as well, conservatorship, guardianship. So you taking the steps to do a plan, to have a healthcare proxy, HIPAA authorization, to have a power of attorney, to do a will and a trust and to ensure that things people are able to step in for you while you're living without the court involvement, but then also you've made things easier for your loved ones and without court involvement later, then an estate plan is something that you can do to achieve that. And each estate plan is different. Yes, there are some documents that everybody should have, the healthcare proxy, the HIPAA, the power of attorney. But your revocable trust may be different from somebody else's. You may have beneficiaries that are on certain benefits. You may just have everything going out right to adult children. You might have minor children. There's so many different avenues and ways of planning that can be done. And so don't think that yours is either too complicated or too simple. Have that conversation with an estate planning attorney. Again, we're from Legacy Legal Planning. We're happy to have those conversations with you. Please feel free to schedule a complimentary 15-minute call with our office. Our number is 781-971-5900. We ask you to check out our Instagram, our Facebook, our LinkedIn. We put out a lot of educational videos and also some funny videos. As you mentioned, you know, we try to have it be a little light. Check it out. Learn about this as much as you can and take the steps to give you that peace of mind and to help your family have that peace of mind. We do believe that peace of mind is in the power of planning. So take that power, empower yourself to go take care of this and ensure that you are taking care of your loved ones and hopefully avoiding this probate process that we've just been talking about.
Sounds absolutely terrifying, and I agree.
Listen, we just said we tried not to terrify.
You said tried.
Yeah, and so just a reminder, if you've been following along, if you missed our journal prompt for the week, we are having you write down tales, memories, recipes, you name it. This is week 6 that we're doing this, and we are asking you to write about a time that you went to work with a parent or if you brought your child to work. Share that memory in your legacy journal.
Jeez, I remember doing that. I was spinning coffees at South Station at Aubon Pan. Oh,
that's going to be a story.
Pops was a manager. What can I say?
Be sure to save the date and put on your calendar May 8th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., the 29th Annual Senior Celebration hosted by South Shore Senior News and Legacy Legal Planning at the Holiday Inn in Dedham. Great place to meet lots of companies that can help provide services for seniors. And we thank you for tuning in, listening to Legacy Legal Live here on WMEX Boston.